been way too long since we did this, isn't it?
Yes, hello everyone.
Yep.
It has been way too long and we really do apologize. There's been a lot of things happening for both here and around the world, and we really need to get back into doing podcasting to make us feel better, really.
And
do some education and
and
some fun. And
so I think what we'll do is
just bring back some smiles.
We'll keep our waffle short so we can actually get on the podcast. But we do hope that everyone listening out there has been keeping safe and well.
Yeah.
And we're with you guys. We're in a lucky area. We haven't been too badly impacted, but here in Australia, there's been entire states locked down for quite some time.
Yeah, exactly. Shout out to my Port Macquarie, New South Wales friends and family down there who are currently in lockdown.
Yeah. Yeah. So
love you all.
So that's enough of that. Let's move on to what's happening now that we can probably do a what the history of in like about 5 years' time. I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of stories from now down the track. So let's go talk about some weird
stuff.
History for your and our pleasure.
Yes, yeah. And we just hope it's beneficial for everyone.
Indeed.
What the?
History.
Hello and welcome to What the History.
Hi,
your hopefully regular bits of bizarre history to make you say What the History. I am Trevor Holland.
And I'm Susie Holland and apologizing for the long time between drinks.
We've already kind of covered that.
Yeah, I know, but I just wanted to let everyone else know again. Okay. I am really sorry for this. It's not like us to do this. So we hope that you've stuck around. We hope that we've put enough feelers out for other people as well. We like to tell people about our podcast and things. Just let everyone know.
And we will keep talking about it every opportunity.
Yep.
So speaking about podcasts, what do you have for us today?
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I have got an interesting one. Of course. Okay. Now, set the scene. He was known as Honest Jack, Jack the Lad, the Jailbird Prison Breaker Extraordinaire, a glamorous rogue, the epitome of the live fast and die young crime set of the 18th century London. He was Jack Shepherd, acclaimed in life as a celebrity, as a subject of verse, newspapers, broadsheets, ballads, books, plays, and burlesque, and immortalized in the afterlife. Jack was born as John Shepherd in Whiteshrow, Spitalfields, on the 4th of March, 1702. His father died when he was young, as well as an older brother, John, who Jack was named after, and his younger sister dying in infancy. His younger brother, Tom, survived. Yay! With his mother unable to take care of him, Jack was given to the Bishopsgate workhouse at the age of 6. It was at the workhouse where he was indentured to a cane chair maker until the master died and Jack was apprenticed to another cane chair maker, who sadly mistreated him. Mm-hmm. When Jack was 10, he was working as a shop boy for William Kneebone, a wool draper, who had also employed Jack's mother after Jack's father died. William taught his new employee to read and write. Oh, isn't he sweet? Before Jack was apprenticed to a Covent Garden carpenter at the age of 15. Jack showed skilled promise in his new trade, and at the age of 20 in 1722, with a little over a year to go on his apprenticeship, he began hanging out at the drinking establishment of many of London's shady criminal underworld, called the Black Lion, where, while being a diminutive 5'4", I know the feeling, Jack, I'm 5'4" as well, he was quite popular for his charm, wit and banter. Here, Jack the Carpenter would begin his new life as Jack the Jailbird and Prison Breaker. It was here he met a prostitute by the name of Elizabeth Lyon, a.k.a. Edgeworth Bess, who had become his lover and partner in crime and gang leader, Jonathan Wilde, a.k.a. the Thief Taker General. After he met Joseph Blake, aka Blueskin, the crimes amped up and he had a fight with his master, quitting his apprenticeship.
No.
With a year to go, gosh. Without a master, but more than considerable skill in carpentry and building materials, he set himself up as a freelance carpenter, repairing and stealing from wealthy properties in Mayfair and passing these items to Elizabeth. His first crime was recorded for shoplifting, but dropped due to lack of evidence. 1723 was a busy year for Jack. It was also the year of his first prison break. Sent to St. Giles, some sources say St. Anne's, Roundhouse in 1723 for pickpocketing and thieving from various houses, Jack was visited by Elizabeth, who in turn was recognised as one of Jack's accomplices and promptly arrested. They were jailed together in the new prison in Clerkenwell, where Jack located a metal file, filed off his irons, put a hole in the wall, removed an iron and wooden bars from the window, and he and Elizabeth knotted bed sheets and blankets together and made their escape by climbing down the wall, scaling the gates of the prison and dropping to the ground. Being free didn't stop Jack from his life of crime, and now he was a celebrity amongst London's criminal element after robbery and housebreaking crimes with his old mate, Joseph, aka Blueskin, which included stealing from his previous employer, William Kneebone. Mm-hmm. Naughty Jack. Jack blamed his old black line mates for steering him down the wrong path. Some of the crimes included his brother Tom, with Tom being brought up to the Old Bailey, found guilty and branded on his hand as a thief. Mm. It was this robbery from William that caused the sentence of death to be passed upon Jack and Joseph at the Old Bailey on the 12th of August 1724, having been turned in from information supplied by Jonathan Wild. Dear, oh dear. Jack was carted off to Newgate Prison and obviously wasn't content to rest on his laurels, and on the 30th of August made a second prison escape. In Newgate, there was a hatch with iron spikes leading into a passage, which in turn led to the cell where condemned prisoners awaited their fate. Jack amazingly got hold of another metal file. Why they just leave these lying around?
They should be more careful.
They should. And filed away one of the spikes. Elizabeth and another one of Jack's girlfriends who was visiting with the intention of giving Jack another escape, distracted the guard while Jack snapped the spike, and they helped Jack slide out from between the bars and down to freedom. It helped considerably that the prison guards were drinking down the other end of the building.
One of the more escapes.
Gosh. A week later, Jack and one of his criminal mates saw an opportunity for another robbery, this time from a watchmaker, and they stole three watches before escaping. Soon after, mates told him that another search was underway and he escaped to Finchley, but he was found and clapped back into Newgate Prison, this time into a room called the Castle. The jailers weren't taking any chances this time and put Jack into an elaborate array of heavy padlocks, ironed and chained to a piece of metal fitted to the floor. He managed to find a nail, not a metal file this time, and proudly showed his captors his style by quickly unpicking the locks. The jailers simply put Jack back in the irons again and, for good measure, put him in handcuffs too. Then the jailers left Jack to his own devices. They didn't have to wait long. On the 15th of October, Jack once again escaped Newgate Prison by removing his shackles and escaping up to the castle's chimney into a room used to house Scottish Jacobite prisoners some years before, called the Red Room, where he found another nail, picked the lock of the Red Room, moving along into the chapel, removed an iron spike, and made his way to remove bolts from the doors he found on his way. Jack then made his way back to the castle, found a blanket, and made his escape via an adjoining house where he ate, rested, and then made his way through the front door, the whole time still wearing his leg irons. Gosh. Jack managed to persuade a joiner to remove his irons for 20 shillings and went to a pub where he heard tales of himself and then tore his clothes to disguise himself as a beggar. He robbed a pawnbroker of clothes and finery to show himself off as a gentleman, got to drink with his mum, but then he started drinking at pubs with Elizabeth, which led to his arrest as he was too drunk to resist. Oh, gosh. By this time, Jack's celebrity was out of control. There were ballads written about him, petitions to the king to try and get his death sentence changed to transportation to the colonies, or a full pardon given. And even his portrait was commissioned, which still hangs in the National Portrait Gallery in London.
Wow.
It was all to no avail, having made a laughingstock of the prison system.
Yep.
And having already been convicted, Jack was again sentenced to death on the 10th of November to be hanged at Tyburn Gallows on the 16th of November, 1724. Jack was planning another escape from the gallows, but his concealed knife was found before he could use it. Women threw flowers in the streets before him in the cart, weeping and dressed in white. He went to the gallows a hero, admired by men and women as a lovable rogue. After Jack met his end, a throng of people came forward to protect Jack so the anatomy students couldn't take his body for experiments, which also thwarted Jack's friends from taking the body to a doctor to have him revived, which was another escape plan. Another source says that Jack's many admirers surged forward to pull his legs to give their hero a quick death so he wouldn't suffer. Whatever happened, Jack's badly mauled body was buried in the churchyards of St. Martin's in the Fields. Jack Shepherd died a folk hero, thumbing his nose at authority and living the life the way he wanted. Daniel Defoe, author of Robinson Crusoe, was so impressed by Jack's exploits that he ghostwrote his autobiography, A Narrative of All the Robberies, Escapes, etc., of John Shepherd in 1724. The Houdini of his time, he knew exactly what to do with locks, bolts, and doors after having an excellent understanding of their mechanisms as a builder and carpenter. Jack the Lad, welcome to What the History.
Wow.
Far out.
Yes. That is quite the life of adventure.
It's one of those things that just kept on going and going as I was researching further into it. Just, oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. Go, Jack.
Go, Jack. Well,
yep. Yep.
Well, let's go from something that keeps going and going to something that didn't.
Oh.
I found a segue.
Do tell. Do tell, sir.
Okay. If there's one thing that recent times have taught us, is that things don't always go to plan.
No.
It may be having to cancel a weekend away.
Again.
Or finding the cats have pooed in the wrong spot. Again. And yes, this is from personal experience.
Yeah, sorry.
Some things can also go awry on a much larger scale, like the shenanigans that NASA faced in 1979. Let me set the scene. Launched into orbit in 1973, Skylab was constructed from hardware that was not used after the three final missions of the Apollo moon program were cancelled. The space station had room for three astronauts to conduct research and allowed for crews to be replaced. The first Intrepid researchers ended up being more space repairmen. Skylab had been seriously damaged during the launch, with important shielding and solar panels being lost. They spent 28 days working on and around the station. Two more crews spent time labbing it up in the sky in July 1973 and February 1974. After that, Skylab was left to its own devices, expected to orbit the Earth as space junk. So you can just imagine the reactions in late 1978 when it was discovered Skylab's orbit had started to deteriorate and was expected to come crashing back into Earth at an unknown time and place. One of the ideas initially floated to avoid fiery death from above was to use the in-development space shuttle to push the stricken space station into a higher orbit. But it was soon realised that the shuttle would not be ready in time to make the contribution. With the US government increasingly pressuring NASA to guarantee no US casualties, a plan was finally put into place. The idea was to make Skylab's uncontrolled descent into something a bit more predictable. It was decided that on July 11, 1979, the station's booster rockets would be fired to try to force it to crash harmlessly into the Indian Ocean. Given the checkered history of the Skylab program, the announcement of the forced re-entry caused some mixed reactions around the world. The statement revealing the expected splashdown location and that there was only a 1 in 152 chance of human injury did not inspire universal confidence.
Oh, no.
Plans were made for concerned people to shelter in a smuggler's cave in Devon, England, while the authorities in Brussels, Belgium, planned to use the air raid siren system to warn citizens of potential wreckage. Oh. It wasn't all doom and gloom, though. A hotel in North Carolina decided to host a poolside disco party after designating itself the official Skylab crash zone, complete with a large painted target. On the flip side, shirts and hats with bullseyes on them were sold as anti-Skylab gear, using the logic that NASA couldn't hit anything it aimed for. Other entrepreneurial individuals offered Skylab insurance and even cans of aerosol Skylab repellent.
Stay back, Skylab.
Yep. When the day arrived and Skylab was forced back to Earth, the initial story that all had gone to plan didn't last. While some of the station had indeed landed in the ocean, it broke up during re-entry, leading to debris being scattered across Western Australia. Fortunately, and surprisingly, no one was injured. As the news spread, onlookers and those after a souvenir scoured the area. The San Francisco Examiner offered a $10,000 prize to the first person who could bring them a piece. In an effort to avoid paying any money, they stipulated they needed it delivered to their offices within 72 hours of the crash. They didn't plan on 17-year-old Stan Thornton, who was awoken by the sounds of debris hitting his house in Esperance, West Australia. After hearing about the reward, he gathered some of the charred remains from his yard and, without bothering to pack or even get a passport, caught a plane and turned up at the Examiner before the deadline. Thornton received his reward and became a minor US celebrity. He got to tour the US and was paid to endorse products. The Examiner even paid to fly his family out to keep him company.
He got on there without a passport.
He did. Our times have changed. The legend of the reward even made its way into pop culture, with a portion of the 1986 film Dogs in Space dedicated to the occupants of a Melbourne share house trying to fake Skylab debris by throwing bits of melted toaster off the roof and declaring, "It must be Skylab."
I remember that scene so well.
It's so good. The crash also drew a bit of a conspiracy. John Somerville Smith, a writer for the local Australian newspaper, the Toorak Times, claimed he had been out at Kalgoorlie a few days before and had been tipped off by US staff there that there was a plan to bring Skylab down near the secretive Pine Gap facility so that espionage and spying equipment could be quickly retrieved and returned to the US government with no one the wiser. Even with NASA and the US government actively trying to stop the story, most people remain skeptical. The Shire of Esperance returned to the news after it determined that the heated debris was a fire hazard and issued a $400 fine to the US State Department. The fine remained outstanding until 2009 and was only paid after a US radio station raised the funds and sent them a check on the 30th anniversary of the crash.
Gold.
Perhaps the biggest beneficiary of these crazy events was the small town of Belladonia, a largely unknown outback destination with a population of 9 at the time. Large fiery chunks of Skylab crashed down into the yard of the local hotel because every Australian town, no matter how small, needs to have a pub.
This is true.
Reporters and sightseers made their way to the normally quiet town to talk to the locals and hunt for souvenirs. Guests of the hotel described the sights of the debris falling to earth looking like the fireworks display from the Royal Show. The president of the US, Jimmy Carter, called the owner of the hotel and offered an apology. As Miss Universe pageant was being held in Perth at the time, the decision was made to fly Miss America out to the small town for a photo opportunity. It was reported that Mary Friel spent her time there mostly fed up and trying to stay away from the flies.
Mm-hmm.
The legacy of Belladonia lives on, with a museum dedicated to the events now attached to the hotel. The museum has lasted a bit longer than the musical tribute. The Ballad of Belladonna Knight, released by the group Family in 1979, with lyrics, including the lines, "Before the Skylab crashing down, Belladonna wasn't even on the roadmap. Belladonna Knight, never the same again." There are still groups searching for Skylab wreckage today, ensuring the stricken spacecraft will always have a place in What the History.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Absolutely. I mean, I still remember, because I was in primary school at the time, given my age. And that was in Queensland. And even there, we were talking about, what a Skylab falls down near us.
See, yeah, I don't remember anything about this where I grew up, because we're not too much different in ages, and I'm not giving away my age here at all. But, yeah, I can't remember anything about it.
No, fair enough.
But I was in New South Wales.
Yeah.
And if it didn't happen in Sydney.
It didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
Oh, good.
Or Brisbane. Mm. Or Melbourne.
Absolutely. Right. So thank you for listening to our new episode of What the History.
That was very interesting. Thank you for listening.
I haven't done this for a while. I'm a bit out of practice.
Oh, you did well. You did well.
Cool, cool. Now, if you do want to know more about what we've discussed, all the references are going to be in the podcast description down below.
Because we research here.
We
don't rely on just one source of Wikipedia.
We don't
even use Wikipedia.
Correct. Where was I? Okay, yeah. All our references are listed down below. You can head to the homepage, the Rufus Project homepage, rufusproject.com, for all our previous episodes and all their references as well. There's a wealth of material there and some bloody amazing.
Absolute doozies. Human beings just do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. We just like to pay tribute to those. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Good or bad on What the History.
Indeed. Now, if you're new to What the History, you've managed to start the process in some way, you can subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, iTunes, your favorite podcast app, and we're also on Amazon Podcast. We were there a while, but it's just made to Australia quite recently.
Yes.
Okay. There you go.
Yes, so we're everywhere now.
You can listen to us on pretty much anything you like. Cool. So we also have a Patreon if you want to help us create more content and exclusive stuff for our awesome Patreon subscribers.
That's right.
Shout out to Christian and Mark. I think they're the only ones I got at the moment.
And I'm sorry about my hair. It doesn't care anymore.
If you want to know what she's referring to with her hair, you're going to join our Patreon and you'll be able to see the replay of this live stream. That's right, we live stream our recordings.
Yes, become a Patreon. See what my hair does.
So you can head to patreon.com/Rufus Project for that. You can get in touch with us at podcast@rufusproject.com. That's a good catch-all for all our podcasts. We have another one called Redeeming Features, which I hope to record again very soon, that I do with the cult guru of Brisbane, Christian Fletcher. All about trying to redeem potentially not redeemable movies. So it's not just a bad movie podcast. We try to redeem them. But we do it honestly, so we don't always succeed.
No.
Excellent.
But they try.
We do. So, again, thank you for joining us here at What the History. And we'll be back as soon as humanly possible with two more bizarre bits of history to make you say, what the history? All right. See you later.
Bye.